This is Sign Language with Bruce Williams and Doc Goldstein.
Hi, and welcome to episode 176 of Sign Language. This is Bruce Williams from signlanguagepodcast.com.
And this is Doc Goldstein from LA.
How are you, Doc?
I'm good.
Excellent.
I have my Neumann on today because I had used it recently, so it was already on the mic stand and on the big boom, you know, the Atlas boom that I use. So
right.
I plugged it in, so if I sound a little bit different tonight, that's why.
And which Neumann is it?
It's a old U87. It's so old, it's got the compartment inside for batteries.
Oh, wow.
You know, from back before, yeah. 48 volts was always phantom power, you know?
Yeah, right. So is that 9 volt or 12 volt?
Well, no, this takes 48 volts. The batteries were like, I don't know, it's been a while since I've opened it up, but I think they were like 22 volt and you put two of them in there or something like that.
Wow. Okay. You know,
actually, I'm kind of embarrassed that I don't remember, but I haven't opened this thing up in like a couple of decades, you know, but... But this is an older U87, like when they first came out. And so it doesn't have quite the volume that the newer AI model has.
Okay.
But I have AB'd them, and they both sound extremely similar, but once you get the levels matched.
Right.
And I love this mic, you know, it's great.
Did I tell you the anecdote about the U87 that we were using at the Australian Radio Network and me sending it out for a refurb?
No, you didn't, but let me hope you didn't get it too near a set of drums, because that's what happened to this one.
No, so what happened was during the entire 9 years that I was at ARN, I had in my voiceover booth this U87, which I knew was somewhere in the vicinity of 40 years old. It had come from another studio in Sydney when they'd sold off when they closed down. And I was using that for the whole 9 years that I was there. And around about the 7 year mark, I started to notice that the mid range around 4 to 6K was starting to sound a little bit crunchy, like it was distorting just in that frequency range. And I thought to myself, something's going on here. And I asked around and asked the chief technician, and I said, have these mics, you know, this 40-year-old U87, has it ever been refurbished? Has it ever been serviced? And he said to me, well, not in my time. And I said, I think it might be due. Can we send it out for a refurb? And he said, yeah, sure. He said, can you look into who would do that and get a quote for me? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So I started making inquiries, and it turned out that Sennheiser Australia is now the authorized repairer and service agent for Neumann.
Right.
And so I got in touch with them and I said, look, this is the story. Got this old U87. It's starting to sound a bit crunchy in the upper mid-range. Could we get it refurbed? And they said, yeah, sure, bring it over and we'll organize a quote for you. Anyway, they came back and they said, this is the quote, and we'll put in a brand new K87 module capsule, because that's the capsule inside the U87. It's a K87 capsule. It'll be X number of dollars and so on and so forth. So I said, okay, beautiful. And I got back to the tech and I said, this is what it's going to cost. And he went, yeah, that's great. Go ahead, get it done. And I said, okay, what have you got for me to use in the meantime? And they gave me an SE Electronics, which is, as you may know, is a company that Rupert Neve has had a little bit to do with. And they gave me one of their mics, and a 2200A. And this is a $500 condenser mic. So, you know, a sixth of the price of a U87. And I put this thing in the booth and went, holy crap, that sounds great.
Oh, and yeah, well, you know, Rupert.
The voice, right? Yeah, exactly. And then the voiceover guy that I did a lot of promo work with, he's a real audiophile, and he came in and he went, oh, what's this? And I said, oh, it's a SE Electronics 2200A. I've got it while the U87's being refurbed. And he plugged his headphones in and stepped up to the mic and went, wow. He said, I like this. And I said, yeah, I know. I'm really impressed with it. You know, for a cheap mic, it really sounds good. Anyway, to keep the story short, a month later, when the U87 came back with a brand new K87 capsule in it, I put it up and just went, nah, I'm sticking with the 2200A. And for the remaining 2 years that I was at ARN, the U87 sat in the corner as my backup, and we used the 2200A as the everyday workhorse.
Yeah, I think you did tell me this story. I remember not liking it then. I don't like it now.
Yeah, anyway.
You know, this just proves that you can get good equipment from almost anywhere in the globe now. You know,
it's absolutely.
It's no longer true that if a microphone is made in Asia, that it's not a good microphone. You know, it's just not true. You know, there's a lot of good stuff that comes out of there.
It also shoots down the myth that if something's 50 years old and came from Germany, it must be the best thing available.
No, wait a minute.
Look, I'm not dissing Neumann because they are beautiful mics, you know, yeah. And I just thought it was an interesting, you know, situation that even when it came back with a brand new capsule, that, you know, there was just something about this SE mic that just really appealed to both me and the voiceover guy.
So well, anyway. Yeah, you know, I haven't played with the SE mics, but I've heard nothing but good things about them. And I have no reason to doubt what you say about it, you know.
Yep.
What I tell my students with the 87 is if you have to do a vocal and you have no idea what the right mic is, or if you have to do anything, piano or whatever it is, and you just don't know what the right mic is, but you know you want a condenser, if you slap an 87 on there, it's never going to be bad.
Exactly. It will never disappoint you. Yeah.
Right. You know.
Yeah.
I can also say lately, though, you know, AKG has a newer version of the 414, which has, you know, been their
yep.
one of their top of the line mics forever, and this new version came out a few years ago. It's not brand new like today, but
no.
This is the one where unless it sees phantom power, you don't know where the switches are because the switches are now LEDs.
Oh right, you know? Is this the XLS2?
Well, there's two versions. There's one with a gold windscreen on it, and there's one with a silver, and the difference is in the mid-range boost, whether it has it or not. And one of them, right. I think, is the two. But I just want to say that these microphones are another example of a mic that never sounds bad.
Yeah.
You know, lately, in fact, it's my favorite piano mics. So
is that right?
I've been using these a lot, you know. But
yeah, nice.
So now, here we are.
For this episode of the podcast, even though the listener won't hear it because Doc records his voice at his end and then sends me the WAV file and I then mix the two of them together.
On a Pro Tools. Using I just Skype. Want the world to know that my side is on Pro Tools. Damn it, Jim.
That's right. But for this episode, we are not recording via Skype. We are using a thing called Source Connect. Now, Doc, you've worked with Source Connect in the past, and I'd heard about it, but had never used it. What's your understanding of the product? Because we were having a little bit of a conversation before we started recording, and I said, oh, this is too good. We should include this in the podcast.
Well, we used to use it when I was at the big studio. We used it to lock two Pro Tools together across the globe to do ADR. Before that, we were using ISDN phone lines, which is extremely expensive. Like you can have a $9,000 phone bill from, you know, on it for a day. I'm not exaggerating. It's very expensive because of the phone line usage that you have to use. Because they have to tie a million POT lines together. POTs meaning plain old telephone service. You have to tie a bazillion of those things together to get the three or four lines or two or three, depending on bandwidth, that you have to get for ISDN. So when Source Connect came along, at first it was a little unstable. It would crash Pro Tools, and then they got that fixed, and now it's pretty solid.
Right.
And I haven't paid attention to it really since I left the studio. But then, you know, when we were getting ready for this podcast, you sent me this link to go to a Source Connect application that I actually didn't know they had, because in the old one that I used to use, we had to have it at both ends of the phone call, you know, to connect the two Pro Tools rigs together. But now, here you sent me a link, and I'm online with you through Source Connect, and I didn't have to pay anything, so I like that.
Yeah.
But it looks like it's at 120 kilobits per second.
Yeah, so you can actually change the bit rate of the either what I send to you or what you send to me.
Yeah.
But the way this came about was that you know, probably 6 months ago now, I had to make the move to Windows 10. And what I found is that Skype has been nothing but a problem ever since. And so I was looking around for an option that I could move to for these kinds of podcast recording scenarios should Skype ever get to a point where it's just no longer usable, because it just seems that everything Microsoft touches, they tend to bugger up. And I'd heard of Source Connect for years and years and years, but I'd never really looked at it because I thought it was a really expensive proposition. And in doing some hunting, I found that they now have this thing called Source Elements, which is free to use. You can host a 10-person conversation for free with an unlimited time limit. And the way it works is that, assuming members of that conversation don't have a Reaper or Pro Tools rig that they can record their voice to, the Source Connect module will allow each user to record their own part of the conversation, so their own audio, but not the rest of the conversation, which means that if I wanted to do a roundtable with half a dozen people on a call, everyone could record their own audio and then send it to me, and I could then drop all of those audio tracks into Reaper and have a 6-channel conversation where I've got split audio so that I could cut and edit and tighten up and cut out ums and ahs and do all that sort of stuff, and not have to worry about, oh, if I cut this part, I'm cutting out the person who I still wanted to hear from, where I, you know, just wanted to get rid of the person that talked over them. So I'm pretty impressed with this. I've been using it for Shutter Zinc as well, and this is the first time that you and I have used it. And what I particularly like about it is that if something happened to your recording dock, you know, if something happened and your Pro Tools rig fell over, not that that would ever, ever, ever happen.
Absolutely not. This is a fully professional system, darn it.
That's right. The great thing is that the audio that's coming through from you to me via Source Connect is not dynamically compressed. Yes, it's data compressed, but it's not dynamically compressed. So it doesn't come through looking like a piece of 4x2 like Skype does. So it actually sounds to me like you're in the studio.
Well, that's
great. It's fantastic.
Yeah. It's working great. Now, I'm not sure how they make money on this, though, right now, because I don't have a bunch of... Maybe it's just to get people used to the company. I don't know. But I can tell you that it worked really good for us when you're using it for ADR. But what we were doing is we were tying two Pro Tools rigs together using time code across the globe.
Wow.
Because we were in sync with Pitcher doing ADR. So it was very highfalutin.
Yeah.
And it used a very high quality lossless compression ratio, which is different than this. So, and it cost a little bit, but it worked really well. So what would happen with our client base is our client base would look at this and go, thousands of dollars for a phone call versus an extra few bucks to get the studio to use Source Connect. You know, so we had basically stopped using ISDN and had switched over, and we had to do a lot of messing around to get it to be stable at first.
Right.
You know, like we started, like it was a two-channel system what we were using, and we ended up putting timecode down one channel instead of using their timecode track that they had specified. And, you know, I haven't tried that in a while, you know, but once we did that, however, it worked really great. And that was our method of working. We just told our client base, look, once in a while during the session, it just might crash and we might have to reboot, just so you know. And they would say, well, let me think. We lose a minute because we crash versus thousands of dollars an hour. Gee, you know,
Yeah.
We'll take the crash, you know. So
exactly. Because, you know, even if you had a couple of crashes and even if you had to bill them for one more hour than they were anticipating, it was still going to be a cheaper option.
Oh, yeah. And it was never an hour, just a minute or two just to reboot the computer and we were good to go.
Yeah.
You know, it was no big deal.
Yeah.
You know, we use this on a lot of major motion pictures and big time TV shows, you know.
Yeah, right. So, nice.
They probably still are.
Yeah. Now, I still have in my little text document here some topics of conversation that were sent to us by William LaForge probably 12 months ago. And William, I offer my sincerest apologies that it's taken us this long to even get to this. One of the things that William asked about, Doc, was harmonic distortion, tube versus transformer.
Oh, okay.
Do you need some time to think about that?
No, I don't actually. It's just that, you know, you get on the internet and you read all this crap about how distortion ought to sound and how even odd, you know, even versus odd harmonic distortion and how even's yep. going to sound warm and odd's going to sound bad and blah, blah. And you read all this crap about how you can only sound good with tubes because tubes have tube warmth, you know, and I would like to say that that is just, you know, most of it is just, it's just not that simple. It's not about the parts you use in terms of whether you use a discrete op amp or maybe a That Corporation chip, which sound fantastic. Right. That Corporation is the old DBX folks, you know.
And oh, is that right?
There are no slouches.
No.
So it's more about the quality of the design and the designer, whether or not equipment sounds good or bad. You know, you can throw a tube into something where the plate voltage is starved and it's running on 20 volts and it sounds terrible, but hey, there's a tube in there, so it must be good. So, yes, there is some great sounding tube equipment out there, and yes, a high quality tube microphone has something special about it, you know, like a Bach microphone, B-O-C-K, you know, mm-hmm. David Bach. He makes a fantastic mic. There's other people, you know, Telefunken, who are making great mics. Neumann makes great mics, obviously. There's a lot of people making great mics, and some of them have tubes and some of them don't, right? So it's just yep. not so simple that, oh, yeah, you know, even order. First of all, I don't want my mic to distort. I don't want it to create... you know, even or odd harmonics. If I'm going to create harmonics, I want to do that after the fact so that I can make changes. Like one of the plugins I use, I have a lot of plugins by a company. And by the way, I get no money from anybody on this. So, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not trying to sell anything. But I use a lot of plugins by a company called Sound Toys. And one of their plugins is called Decapitator, which I just love that name.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and if I need some harmonic distortion, I can get plenty out of that because this decapitator shaves the top of your waveform right off of there. You know, no problem.
Right. So it's like a peak limiter.
No, it's like a buzzsaw.
Okay.
Nice. You know, it literally decapitates your waveform. You know,
okay.
And just it turns a sine wave into a square wave, no problem, or anything in between. You know. You know, it's just a great, you can make it sound like an overdriven Neve or maybe some other console that's overdriven or maybe an API or whatever it is.
Okay.
You know, you can drive it harder, you can drive it less. It's just, you know, it's a really good plugin for that. So I'd rather record clean and not have to worry about distortion at that end. Now, I've been recording for a while now, you know, and I just have to say that I'm not afraid to record wet. You know, because when I started out, you know, back when the Donner Party first hit the Rocky Mountains, you know, mm-hmm. here in the States, you know, and dinosaurs ruled the world, you know, I was, you know, started out where you had to record wet or you wouldn't be able to get any effects on there. So I've done that and I'm not against doing that, but I still am not in a big hurry to record with distortion happening. You know, I'm just, yep. that's just me. I'm just not, you know. So on the other hand, there are people who are and... fine. It's fine with me. You know, it's an art and a science, right? So
sure. I've got to say, I'm very much of the mindset these days of just give me the mic that's going to translate the best depending on what the sound is that I'm trying to capture. You know, if it's a vocal, give me, you know, of all the mics in the cupboard, find the mic that sounds the best for that vocal. And, yeah. you know, when you finish recording that vocal and you've got to record a ukulele part, then go through all those mics and work out which mic is going to do the most justice to the sound of that ukulele, you know, or whatever it is that you're recording next.
I would almost agree, but I don't, you know, I've seen instances where people have like killed the singer before they found the right mic, you know, and the singer has like been there for 2 hours trying mics. And that's okay if the singer wants to do that. Like if you're working on a big project with a lot of money behind it and it's an album and they want to spend a day getting just the right sound, that's great. But a lot of times if you hang too many mics in front of a singer, they'll just eat their gun before they finally get to the trying all the microphones, you know.
For sure. Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, experience plays a part, because hopefully as the engineer, if you're familiar with all of those mics, it shouldn't take you hours to work out which of those mics is going to be the best choice for that vocal, for that guitar, for that ukulele, whatever, you know. Hopefully you know your mic collection reasonably well.
Well, you know, one microphone that I really like if I don't want too clean of a sound and it's kind of a edgy kind of a rock thing or an alternative thing, I've had good luck with a Shure SM7, you know, which is a large diaphragm dynamic microphone, you know.
Yep.
I've had good luck if I'm worried about leakage because I've got a singer out there and I've got a drummer out there at the same time. I've had really good luck with an RE20. Because it's got a pretty flat response and it's not real sensitive and doesn't pick up as much drums, you know? So I've had really good luck with that. You know, I've had good luck with some Sennheiser dynamic mics under the same circumstances. So, you know, after a while, you kind of figure out what works and you just go there. And if it's not perfect, you know, always remember that the performance is more important than the engineering, you know, and I teach that
totally to
all my students, you know.
Yeah,
because at the end of the day, the people who listen to the song aren't going to go, "Oh, I can tell you use plugins. I don't like this song, you know."
Exactly.
Or I don't like the microphone choice because it sounds funny above 8K. No, yeah. Nobody's going to say that.
No.
You know, if the music is good, no one cares.
That's right. If you capture the emotion of the song, that's all that matters.
Yeah. And I know we've talked about this before, but, you know, we probably have two more listeners than we had last year. So, you know, we'll let them hear it.
Yeah, absolutely.
What else did we totally ignore this guy on? What else did he ask us that did not answer for a year?
The next thing he had was acoustics and treatment. And in brackets, he wrote, there must be a cheaper way. And on that front, I want to say I've reached out to a guy on Facebook by the name of John Brandt, who runs a page for voiceover booth building, and he's an acoustician. And I'm hoping that I can coerce him into coming on the podcast and have a bit of a chat about room acoustics and that sort of stuff. But Doc, if there's anything that you want to throw in on that topic, I'm more than happy to go there.
Well, I was watching a video by Bruce Osinski, who writes a lot of books on audio, like
Did you mean Bobby Osinski?
Yes, there you go. Thank you.
I
was watching a YouTube video from him earlier today, actually, where he's talking about the difference between isolating a room and making a room sound good inside, which are two completely different things. And I didn't have time to watch it all, but it was because at the point I was watching, he was just talking about isolation. And everything he said was absolutely correct, of course. And and I find his books to be very good as well. So I'm going to go back probably tomorrow, since I have tomorrow off. It's my one day off. I'm going to watch the rest of that video and see what he has to say. But I can just tell you from experience that you need a lot of bass trapping. You need some mid-range treatment. You need diffusion. You've got to have diffusion, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not just as egg cartons do not work. Putting foam, gluing foam to your walls doesn't work. You know, I think Bobby mentioned people putting mattresses on their walls. That doesn't work unless you're going to the mattresses.
Yeah.
You know, so he was talking about isolation. And at that point, he brought out the cinder blocks. Well, you know, that's true for isolation, but it's not true for making a room sound pleasing inside. And I didn't get to that part of the video yet. But I just know from experience that I've used both absorption and diffusion. And so have the acousticians I've worked with who have been a lot of brilliant people.
Yeah.
And you can't, I heard it once said, somebody once said, and I don't know who it was, so I would like to get credit where credit is due, but somebody said, you can't have too many bass traps. And I would just say amen to that, right?
Right.
You know, because it's hard to get rid of bass. It's like sticks to the wall and stays there, you know, and creates this big standing wave that everything else has to ride on top of. So,
yeah.
So for those of you out there who might be listening who think that you can put a bunch of Sonex foam or some type of other foam all over your walls and you're good to go, all you're going to do is make your room sound dead from about 1K up, and it's going to stink.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't take care of the bottom. It doesn't take care of the diffusion. Diffusion's a big deal. I would look it up on the internet and you know. So that's my speech, and I'm sticking to it. So.
Yep. And as crazy as it might sound, I have found quite by default, it was not by design, that one of the cheapest and easiest to come by forms of diffusion for a room is a bookshelf full of books.
Yeah.
Because the books, because they're all stacked in a bookshelf, you know, on their sides, they have depth to them. And when you've got 100 of them in a bookcase, that creates a lot of mass, and that helps to absolutely diffuse the sound waves that hit all those books, because they don't all end flush. You know, if you've got all different types of books, then they're different heights, they're different depths. And so what you've got is this completely random, you know, front-facing element, if you like, the bit that points into the room is completely randomized by the size and shapes and widths and thicknesses of all those books. And the sound waves just hit them and bounce in all different directions. And that is exactly what you want diffusion to do, is to break up the propensity for waves to just bounce straight back in the direction from whence they came.
Oh, yeah. I agree. Bookcase is great. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that way people think I can read. You know, I like it.
Nice. The third topic on William's list was microphones, how they work and how to use them. Mm. Well, how they work is a massive, massive topic, because it all comes down to the type of microphone. A dynamic microphone works completely different to the way a condenser microphone works.
Yeah.
And then you can get into really esoteric stuff like electric condensers, which are different again, and piezoelectric mics, which are different again. But I guess let's just start with dynamic microphones. Essentially, do you want to take this, Doc, or are you happy for me to run with it?
Well, you know, when we were little kids, a lot of us used to hook up a battery to a coil of wire and pick up iron filings, you know.
Right.
Which, you know, when you're five, you don't really get it, but, you know, when you run electricity through a wire, it creates a magnetic field around that wire. If you instead take that wire and coil it up real tight so you have a lot of wire in a small space and hook that up to power, well, then you get even more magnetic flux, as it were, a bigger magnetic field right there, because you're wrapping the wire around itself and compressing all that. And the opposite is true. If you induce a magnetic field around a coil of wire, you get electricity coming out. And that's basically how a dynamic mic works. You know, you take a permanent magnet and you take a coil of wire around it. And then when somebody talks into it, the coil of wire moves because it's hooked up to the diaphragm. And that movement through the magnetic field of the magnet that's already there creates an electrical output. And you just amplify that in a mic preamp. And Bob's your uncle. Isn't that what you guys say there?
That's
Bob's
exactly right.
Yeah.
That's it.
You know, which explains why condenser mics are more sensitive than dynamic mics, because dynamic mics, it's like a ball and chain dragging that damn coil around, you know, with this magnet sitting there, you know.
Yeah. And I think that's probably why dynamic mics and certainly ribbon mics have a propensity to be a little softer on the top end, is because the movement of the diaphragm is weighted down by the magnet that it's attached to. And that has a tendency to slow it down a little bit. If correct me if I'm wrong here, Doc, but that has a tendency to soften the top end.
Yeah, well, I think the magnet isn't connected to the diaphragm. I think the coil is connected to the diaphragm, but there's a magnetic field being generated by the permanent magnet around it, you know, and that puts a drag on it. I totally agree.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, that brings up something. Today we had my advanced class today in one of the schools where I teach. And we did something very dated. You're going to love this. At the request of the drummer, and this was the first time the drummer had made this request without getting a lot of bad attitude from engineers. He wanted to just go old school and have one mic over him and a kick mic and nothing else. And so
nice.
not only was I glad to do that, but I used a ribbon mic for the overhead, you know, a la Ringo, right?
Yeah.
Very, very Ringo. Now, I know that I didn't have a Coles 4038 like Abbey Road, so I used a Royer 122,
yeah,
which is a little more modern sounding ribbon, but nevertheless, it sounded great. And then I ran this, and this is an example of wetness. I recorded it to tape this way. I ran the output of the one overhead mic to an LA 2A on the way to the recorder. So it was you know, baked in.
Yep.
And it really did a nice thing to the cymbals. And the drummer's face just lit up when he heard the first playback. You know, it was
nice.
Great. You know,
so
and
just
the students
out of interest,
are going, wow, I didn't know you could do that. And I thought you had to have, I thought you had to have 120,000 microphones on a drum set, you know. It was great.
So just out of interest, how hard were you hitting the LA-2A with the signal from the overhead?
Only about 2 or 3 dB.
Yeah, nice. Nice.
No more than 3. I was just kissing it with a little
bit. Sweet. You know?
Yeah.
So it would have been a completely mono sound then, because you're only using one overhead mic and one kick mic.
Right. Well, it certainly solved the problem of which way do you pan the drums, right?
Totally. Totally.
Yeah, do you pan the drums like you're sitting on the drums, or you pan the drums like you're standing in front of the drummer? You know, and that question goes on all the time. And my answer is, well, whichever you like, you know. But anyway, it certainly solved that problem.
Yeah. Nice. That's great.
And, oh, he had a front head on his kick drum. So we had a Shure 52 there, which is a bigger diaphragm. It's meant for low frequencies. And it sounded great. He had his front head had no hole in it, no nothing. It was totally jazz kind of thing. A very dated sound. And it was, a 20-inch bass drum. It looked like a 20-inch bass drum to me.
Nice.
The whole thing just sounded very legit.
Yeah, nice. What style of music were they doing?
Roots music, I would say.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. You know.
Nice.
And this is totally appropriate for something like that. Like kind of a Norah Jones thing, you know.
Yep.
Definitely authentic, very high quality, you know, which Norah is, obviously.
Sure.
So I would say it's like that. Didn't have a girl singer, but the drum sound was reminiscent.
Man, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. That was fun.
Okay, so to get onto a condenser microphone for the benefit of William, who asked about how microphones work.
Oh, yeah.
What you've got with a condenser microphone is a backplate which is fixed in the sense that it does not move. Then you have a plate which does move, which is attached to the diaphragm. So as air velocity hits the diaphragm and causes the diaphragm to move backwards and forwards, that causes this front plate, this floating plate, to move closer to and further away from the fixed back plate. And what that does, that movement and that changing of the distance between the two plates, creates a variation in the capacitance. And Doc, I'm going to ask you to describe what capacitance is, because I can't answer that. But it varies the capacitance as the distance between these two plates changes. Am I on track so far, mate?
Yeah. So a capacitor, and I know I've talked about this before, but you know, I have limited sims in my head, so I do repeat. You know, I need an upgrade, you know.
So RAM upgrade.
Yeah, that's exactly. Basically, those two plates that you're talking about in the diaphragm create a capacitor. So a capacitor is two plates that are conductive separated by a dielectric, which is a fancy way of saying something that's insulated that does not connect electricity together.
And in the case of a condenser mic, that's just air, isn't it?
Yes, I believe it is. Yes. So air doesn't, you know, isn't conductive. Rubber isn't conductive. Polystyrene isn't conductive. Tantalum isn't conductive. Yeah. You know, electrolytic paste is not conductive. So if you have one plate of the capacitor that can't move and the other one is caused to move because somebody's screaming into the mic, well, that changes the capacitance, which changes how many electrons can be stored inside this capacitor because of the function between the two plates, you know, and electrical energy is stored in this capacitor because of the capacitance. I'm not explaining this very well. But when you cause the capacitor value to change, that means that current has to go somewhere. And that current is what's amplified and becomes the output of the mic. And because it takes very little to move that movable diaphragm, the mics are very sensitive. So capacitors act like, if you look at it from the outside and you're not really watching what's going on, capacitors act like they pass AC, and whatever frequency they stop passing it, like low frequencies, depends on the value of the capacitor and other components that are hooked up to it, like resistors. But electricity actually doesn't pass through a capacitor, you know. But when you get a bunch of electrons stacked on one plate and they can't go to the other plate, the field of those electrons, that negative force, is felt on the other side of the capacitor, which causes electrons to feel that and run like hell the other direction. And then when the polarity changes around, because we're talking about audio, which is AC, then the whole thing works the other direction. So I know I'm oversimplifying it, but this change in power and electrons being negatively charged and getting out of dodge when they feel that coming from the other plate, even though current is not literally passing through there, electrons are flowing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a transformer that the primary and the secondary don't ever touch each other, but the magnetic field between them causes electricity from one to go to the other, and yet it's isolated. So it's got a similarity to that in a way.
Right. Yeah. And am I correct in thinking that the phantom power, which we all understand is required to make a condenser microphone work, that is actually being fed into the fixed backplate, and it's therefore the floating plate moving closer to and further away from that interferes with that flow of power? Is that right?
Well, I think you have to bias that back plate, but I also think you have to power the electronics that are inside the microphone to make all this stuff work. So I think the phantom power is doing both.
Right.
Now, I'm not a mic designer, so I'm not really clear on how much of the phantom power they use to charge that back capsule, but, you know, that's a little farther than I want to go because I don't want to say the wrong thing.
Fair enough.
But there's also electronics that have to happen inside that microphone, and they're going to need power as well.
Right.
But the 48-volt phantom power, you know, one of the things I do talk about with phantom power is, why do they call it phantom power? You know, did Casper invent it or what? You know, I've always been told it's called phantom power because since it goes up the high and the low side of the audio, you don't see any extra wires for the so that's why it's phantom power, because you don't see it, you know.
Right.
There's a 48-volt power supply in the console or in the preamp or whatever it is you're using.
Yep.
And that is split to two 1.8K resistors, and one resistor goes to pin 2 of the microphone and the other one goes to pin 3. So that voltage is not amplified by the mic because of the common mode rejection ratio. Yep. In other words, when you put the same signal on the low side and it's the high side, they cancel each other out. So this phantom power isn't amplified.
Right.
Which is why you can have ripple and phantom power and it doesn't hurt you all that much, although none of us like that. You know, you can buy, at least used to be able to buy, outboard phantom power supplies that had ripple in them, and it didn't matter because the mic would not, you know, amplify anything that was the same on both the high side and the low side. You know?
Sorry, just to wind that back, what's ripple?
A ripple is when you convert AC to DC. Well, it's a drink, actually, in the States. No, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, right. No, when you convert AC to DC, when you leave the rectifier part of that circuit, there's still a remnant of the bumpiness of the AC, and you have to filter that out with capacitors that charge up and then release slowly so that you have an even voltage output. And if you don't have those capacitors in there, or you don't have enough, or the capacitors are dead because they're out of an old Fender amplifier that's 20 years old, or whatever the case may be, you end up getting ripple, which is remnants of the AC bumpiness, if you will, of that DC.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So. Wow. Okay. My head's exploding.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, if it sounds good, use it. I do have a pet peeve about microphones, and I've probably also said this before, but I've had a lot of people ask me, look, I don't have a lot of money. I want to get one good microphone and use that for everything. And I think we've talked about this in a past podcast, you know.
Possibly.
But for those two listeners that weren't there then, let me just say, that's a bad idea because microphones are not flat frequency response wise. Some microphones have a big boost in the upper mid range so that they carry for a longer distance. Others have a low frequency roll off to worry about proximity effect or just to roll off the bottom. And so, and some of these mics are very expensive. So before you buy microphones, you need to look at the tech chart and take a look at both the polar pattern, so you know what direction the mic picks up from and what frequency response implications there are with that. You also need to look at the frequency response just on a flat chart, because you don't want to take the frequency response of one mic and instill that into every track you record.
Exactly.
What if your mic has a 3D boost at 7K and you put that on every track you record because you don't know any of this stuff because you didn't bother to read the specs?
Yeah.
So don't do that.
I kind of liken that to asking the question, what if you said to, you know, Da Vinci, you've got to paint everything you paint with one brush? You know, it's like asking someone to paint a painting and you got to use the same brush for every stroke on that painting. Yeah, it's just not appropriate.
Well, he was so smart, he'd probably figure out a way. He'd probably pull bristles out, you know.
Yeah, who knows? Exactly.
You know, he's like the Alan Parsons of painters, right?
Yeah, exactly. Give me a large brush and I'll paint all the big blocky bits first and then rip some of the bristles out.
Right. So, you know. But I agree with what you're saying, you know. But most people don't think about that when they think about microphones. They just think that if it's an expensive mic, it must be accurately representing what it's in front of. And that's not actually true. Microphones are designed to have frequency response anomalies intentionally to be used for different purposes. And you have to know about that stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's my soapbox right there. That's my daily
Fantastic.
Soapbox.
All right, Doc. Well, I think we'll wrap it up for here. William's still got a couple of other things that he asked about, but we can save that for another episode.
You know, he's not the only person that had questions. Like, we keep circling around and haven't talked about the DB versus DBM versus DBV. You know, we've got, you know, I'd like to apologize to all the listeners who think we don't care about this stuff. We really do. You know, it's just hard for us to get, you know, well, I obviously can't focus. That's clear just from listening to me talk. But secondly, you know, there's just limited time, you know.
Exactly.
But we will get
and
there.
I do want to have that discussion. I really
yes,
do.
Me too.
So, yeah. Mate, good to catch up.
Always good to talk to you, Bruce.
And we'll catch up soon.
Okay. So, yeah, keep that Source Connect happening. I'm liking this.
Yeah, you know, totally.
Because you remember, just one last thing, you will remember that we had all kinds of problems with Skype, you know, on some of our podcasts. There was a couple times when we tried to record a podcast and we just went down in flames, you know, because we couldn't do it, which would not have happened if you were a Mac guy. I just want to say, okay.
All right, mate. Good to chat. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Sign Language. Another audiotoyou.com quality podcast. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@signlanguagepodcast.com.